You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
The 3CR Gardening Show is coming to you today from the Woi Wurrung Nation. We acknowledge the Wurundjeri people as the traditional owners of this land. We recognise the practices of care and cultivation of the land and waters by the First Peoples and pay our respects to their elders past and present. Wherever you are and wherever you garden, we encourage you to know whose land you're on.
Welcome, folks, to another 3CR Garden Show. My name's John Arnott, and we're here on the winter solstice. So it's a winter solstice garden show. And to mark the winter solstice, a bunch of us last night, we went swimming in the bay. It was the winter solstice swim down at Bombeach. What a silly thing to do. We've got a terrific show lined up for this morning. We've got three terrific panellists covering some really interesting and diverse aspects of 3CR's wonderful world of horticulture, ecology, environmental stuff. So in the studio, I'm joined by Emmeline Bowman, founder and director of STEM Landscape Architecture and Design, which is a Melbourne-based studio focused on sustainable design.
That's it.
Hey, Em, thanks for coming in this morning.
I'm very happy to be here.
It's great.
And now we know our days are going to get a little bit longer after today.
Yeah, well, this is it. This is the shortest day.
I know.
There's a technical definition of what the equinox is. It's something to do with where the sun sits on the horizon.
That's right.
That's right. Also joined by Greg Balderston, horticulturist. I'm going to call you the curator. Head gardener?
No, not head gardener.
Not head gardener?
No.
Curator?
I don't know.
Horticulturist?
I'm just there. Just do stuff there.
And there is Forest Glade Gardens in the Macedon Range. Thanks for coming in this morning.
Good morning. I think it's, what do they call it? A special projects manager, I think.
Oh, is that your actual title?
At some time, yeah.
Special.
I don't know if that
I'd like to introduce the special projects manager for
there.
That. Yeah. Thanks for coming in,
no
Greg.
Worries.
Jay Iwasaki. Who is a native bee ecologist, a researcher, an educator, and an environmental advocate, and also a councillor at Merivale. Thanks for coming in, Jay.
Good morning. Thank you. I was wondering why it was so dark this morning.
Yeah, not shortest day. Literally the shortest day is today. Yeah. And thanks to Di. I think Susie's still on her way in, but thanks for Di for coming in and holding forward and making sure that we can get this show to air. So thanks, Di, for coming in. Jay, I reckon this is the second show that you've the garden show that you've done.
Yes, that's right.
But you do have a bit of a tradition of coming into the 3CR studio doing another show. Was it Dirt Music or Dirt Radio?
Dirt Radio. I was on Dirt Radio for a bit, helping with that.
Yeah. And what's the Dirt Radio thing? Because it's not going now, is it?
No, unfortunately, we lost enough people to keep it going for a bit.
Yeah.
So I think it's about 2 years ago that just had to wind it down a bit.
Yeah. Unlike the 3CR gardening show. So, folks, I think most 3CR listeners know that it's the 50th celebration of the show. So the studio started in 76, and soon after, 1977 was the first reference to a gardening show, which makes it the exact same vintage as Greg Balderston. So it was September 1977.
Oh, I'm older than it then.
September 1977 was...
I'm older than it then.
Yeah, okay.
Oh my God. Yeah.
So weeks, just months.
Weeks.
Some weeks older than the 3CR garden show.
Yeah.
So what a nice pedigree. But, incredible. For 49 years, people have been coming in every Sunday morning. It's always been the Sunday morning slot.
Yeah.
For 49 years.
It's actually remarkable.
And the volunteers and the fact that it's, we're not getting paid by some of the biggest radio companies. No, nothing like that.
Not Carl and Jackie O. Yeah, thank God.
What a mess that is. Jesus.
But it's people just who want to do it and believe that it should be done, and they've been doing it for, well, the garden show for nearly 50 years.
Nearly 50 years.
And
so next year.
CCR for 50, yeah.
So we better throw a party, I reckon, just for the garden show next year.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Amazing.
It would be amazing.
And thank you to everyone who has listened to keep it going. Like, that's a, and, you know, people love gardening and horticulture and plants. It just shows you.
We've achieved a sort of like a community of hosts and regular guests. I think there's 36 on the books at the moment.
Oh, that's great.
But there's a community of listeners. That's the thing. It's an entire ecosystem of people.
All over the world.
Yeah, that's something I learned from Dirt Radio, is that it's not just, you need the critical mass of people doing the work, which is actually like way more than I imagined to do a small radio show, but you need the listeners who support it to keep you going too.
Yeah, indeed.
We're going to have a dedicated show just for to mark the 50th anniversary of the station on the 12th of July. And I've been doing a bit of research on, you know, the backstory of the 3CR Garden Show, which was informed beautifully by Gwen Elliott, who did, I'll get this right for the show, but, you know, it's approaching 30 years, might even be a little bit more than that. But for every show that Gwen did, she brought in an exercise book, wrote down the name of the panellists which were on the show. She wrote down the questions that were coming in, the location of the people who were asking the questions, and the nature of the question. So there's an archive of 30 years of 3CR Q&A questions.
Why are the Elliots so amazing?
Extraordinary people, extraordinary people. So, and they're all in exercise books. I think there's, you know, 9 volumes of these exercise books that started in 1998 and went through, you know, incredible.
Well, let's hope it goes for another 50 years.
Yeah, indeed.
And we get out the archived books. And
So I don't think people will be referencing this show particularly. Like, just give each other.
They could. It could be a cracking focus.
It's not over
yet. No, it's not over yet. We have got a really interesting show lined up with this panel where we've got, you know, horticulturists. I'm going to call you an amateur mycologist and a bloody naturalist as well. You know, your designers are all around ecology and stuff like that. You know, sustainability. And, you know, we've Jay here, who is a bee ecologist, and it's Dr. Jay. We should have introduced it. Dr. Jay.
Dr. Counselor.
Dr. Counselor.
You know, we've got
like a song.
Yeah. We've got heaps of, and heaps of time. So we'll talk urban ecology. We'll talk pollinators in the course of the show. But your CV, Jay, it's a really interesting CV. You want to just give, I think this is the second time you've been on the show, so a lot of people don't know you within the 3CR community. What's your story?
Well, I'm a wildlife biologist by education, and then did research at Harvard University in biomechanics, actually.
Biomechanics?
With dragonfly predation and modeling how dragonflies catch their prey with acceleration, deceleration, success rate, modeled in 3D kinematics with
high-speed
cameras.
Was that about biomimicry and informing what we do in the Army or Air Force?
A lot of that, does go into defense stuff, but my supervisor did not take defense money, which was
good.
Which is great.
He had ethics,
for
a certain type of ethics.
But you know, those sort of things are looking into micro air vehicles. So there is even a project called RoboBee at Harvard MIT, designing a very small robotic bee for ostensibly a search and rescue, but more likely. This is like 10 years
ago. Yeah, it's already out there.
And then I did my PhD in ecology, studying interactions between native and introduced bees in New Zealand. Native bees being the ground nesters in New Zealand anyway.
Right.
And introduced bees, honeybees, European honeybees, and bumblebees.
Okay. And then, bumblebees are in New Zealand?
They are, yes. Yeah. They were brought over to pollinate clover.
To pollinate clover.
The dairy farm.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that was over 100 years ago they were brought, because they realized even back then that the clover was not going to seed, and we needed some help.
Okay. And as councillor at Merribeek, is your portfolio the environment portfolio, or?
Yeah, I focus on arts and culture and climate and nature.
Those are climate and nature.
Yeah.
Two things which are absolutely fundamentally linked.
Exactly. Yeah. And from a city's perspective, climate and nature are very linked.
Yeah.
Urban cooling is reliant on good canopy cover, and that's relevant to climate.
You know, it's interesting that it's good canopy cover, but it's also the health of the canopy cover. There's a correlation between a healthy tree and the amount of transpiration it does, and a non-healthy tree. Mm. Like some of the thinking now is that if a tree is under stress, it's actually not making that big a contribution beyond the shade.
Mm.
It's not making that big a contribution to the urban cooling thing. So, you know, if you want to cool a suburb, a street, a community, a town, plant trees and water them.
Yeah.
Interesting. And you know, you've studied it in the States.
Yes.
When did you come to Australia?
Well, I moved to New Zealand in 2012.
2012, yeah.
And then Australia 4 years after that.
Okay.
So then I've been here quite a while, and I'm more than a third, going on half my life. I don't want to talk about it. Suddenly that sneaks up on you.
Yeah. What, middle age? Yeah.
I'm not there yet. No. Well, maybe I am. Getting to the point where maybe you can make a difference, or you feel like you know enough to start making a difference.
What it's all about. I mean, that's the other thing about this community of people, is that for 3CR panelists, everyone's making their a contribution to a healthier, better planet in their own ways.
Mm.
It is a wonderful community of people. What's on your books at the moment, Em?
Oh, we've been doing lots. We've been on site a lot. We've been... we actually have been really fortunate to be working more on site just recently. So we've been in the Macedon Ranges.
Okay.
We have a couple of projects, really large rural projects, and it sort of got to a point where one of the projects, a client got quite sick for a good couple of years, and unbeknownst to us that the garden was completely left.
It doesn't take long for a garden to decline, does it?
Well, the nice thing was we were on another project where we've been working on. It's the one in Macedon, in Drummond, and we were working on there and thought, oh, yeah, this one's been left for 2 years, so, oh, God, we're in for it. We're going to get some good abs out of this workout when we get rid of these weeds. But I am pretty impressed by going back and then all the shrub mass and the trees are just, you know, quite mature now. And there is a bit of weed, but to be fair, when we went through and we got the weeds out quite easily, it looks great. Like, it wasn't too bad.
Yeah.
You're like, really? We've got a lot of the pasture grass out and we're going to have to put some plants back in. But other than that, for 2 years left by itself, it's pretty good. And we only did, we've done about 4 days of work on a farm, on a big, like, wetland as well.
Oh, that's terrific.
Yeah.
Because, you know, one of your philosophies is that sustainable horticulture. Mm-hmm. That's proof in the pudding.
And that's why I was like, this is why, I mean, as you age, it's very good because the knowledge bank just keeps on happening, you know. All the choices that you made, some of them work, and there was obviously failures.
Yeah.
But all in all, it all held itself together, and it was just like the really small perennial stuff at the front. Those sort of things were the ones that we lost because, you know, there was rabbits and then the pasture grass comes and just smothers it all. But the shrub mass is all there, and it was, you know, got birds. There was different types of finches. We had all the honey eaters. Something that we were a bit like, and something I'd like to touch on is...
Yeah.
There was a big burn pile of, because it's a whole farm, so it's even from other areas of the garden, but they've collected this, like, massive pile. Like, it could be a good day to burn if it's, you know, the equinox.
Yeah.
Anyway, but the thing is, though, this thing is huge, this pile of mass, and we found that there was a whole family of red-brow or firetail finch in there, living.
Using the fern pile as their habitat.
Yes. And it's like that thing where, and I was just telling like my staff, I was like, this is why, you know, when you do get these burn piles, you've got to be kind of quick work on them because they do become habitat very, very quickly.
Very
especially
quickly.
If it's in an open paddock.
Yep.
And there's no other refuge. They go in there.
Yeah.
And it's like we're just seeing like the family of finches. What about all the snakes, the lizards, the skinks, the insects? I'm like, oh, I just look at that pile. I'm like, it's 2 years of homes, you know.
You have to incorporate it into the garden somehow.
Oh, yeah. Well, we started like taking, because we made our own burn pile and we were just like getting rid of some dead branches and stuff. So I just started taking off like some of the dry stuff, trying to like reduce. I was like, there's no hope.
No.
This thing's the size of a paddock. But yeah, it's interesting.
It is, isn't it? Because if you leave something long enough, it is going to.
Yeah.
Yeah, nature's going to
come. Everything's nature, habitat.
Yeah. Everything's habitat. Nature hates a void.
Yeah,
it's,
I know.
It's going to occupy it. It's going to all, yeah.
But it was very interesting to see that there was so much, like we did have a lot of shrub mass and trees. And obviously the garden now is about 4 years old. So we don't really have like shrubs as big as like 5 meters width by height yet.
Sure. So you don't have that.
So and niche. That, yeah. And so that's why the birds were in there.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, yeah. We're so close, but now they've let this become their habitat. And yeah, there's anyway. It as I said, it's all you take note of all of this.
And, you do, and yes, it is about monitor observations and stuff like that. Our citrus tree at home is just getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger.
Mm.
Now I want to prune it, but every time I go to prune it, I look at there and there's. Dainty swallowtail larvae on there or eggs.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, if you prune that off and put that into the compost, there's a generation of caterpillars.
Those butterflies are beautiful.
So, consequently, it's getting bigger and bigger. And at some point, I'm going to need to prune it. But
well, you can also do what I did when I was in uni and raise the butterflies in a little jar.
Do that thing.
Yeah.
Have your home larval food plant stock.
You can you can buy like these great little butterfly enclosures just from pet shops. I used to do it as a kid.
Yeah.
It's really fun, and you just trim off all those branches as long as obviously they've gone into the catalyst.
Yeah.
Put them in this enclosure. It looks like a little tent, like a shower tent. Mm-hmm. And honestly, leave them in there until it gets into spring with a bit of food, and then. Off they go.
You got to watch the caterpillars
It's incredible. Really cute,
I did work at the Melbourne Zoo for a little while and with the butterfly house. So,
perfect.
So I should be able
to. What are you waiting for?
That,
and then you can we get to observe and cut down your cherry. Look, it's all
perfect, perfect. And you mentioned pet shops. You used to work in pet shops.
Yeah, I used to work.
A family pet shop.
No, it was, I used to work at an aquarium. So I did, after I finished high school, I worked at an aquarium when I was 18. I became a manager at 18. I thought I was so good.
How about you? Go, girl.
Loser. But no, I worked there and, yeah, I'm really into fish. I love fish.
Do you?
Yeah, I love. That's why I like water and waterways. But, yeah, I'm into fish. And actually, funny story is Adrian Keane, who comes here, I actually met him there back in the day. So
in Gippsland?
Yeah. So me and Adrian grew up in Gippsland. He was from Joongabby. I was from Winnandoo, which is near Rosedale. We used to catch the bus together, but we went to separate schools in the valley.
Right.
But I always remember being 18. He was a year younger. And, I was... He came in, this cute little boy with massive, you know, curly hair, and he started, like, just rambling off. He's like, oh, really nice Trophius du Boisier. Oh, no, he was just talking. And I was like, how did you know that name? I was like, oh, you know your stuff. No one in Traralgon knows their stuff. And I kind of thought, I'm like, do you want a job? You know, do you need something after school? Oh, I would love to. Oh, my goodness.
Excellent.
And then what happened was I ended up moving to Melbourne, and I did bioscience and zoology, and Adrian stayed on in that aquarium. And I ended up working at another aquarium out here in Melbourne.
Yeah.
And then I did bioscience and zoology, transferred into landscape architecture, and we were all supposed to sit on a table to do the interviews. And Michael Howard was the guy who was sort of hosting it. Well, I think it was Jane maybe. Anyway, She's like, everyone get onto a table. Don't be scared of each other. I sit down on a table, look up, and who is it? It's Adrian. Adrian Key. We both go to the same course together, landscape architecture.
You've been circling around
and
each
never
other.
Even chatted to each other when I gave him the job. Like I didn't, they just sort of left it. It was like sliding doors. And then
we
both got into the course. We're really great friends. Did our masters together, even lived together. We're still good friends.
Amazing.
Yeah. So anyway, but
we better roster a show just for old time's sake.
I know, but it's one of those nice moments. But yeah, back to like aquariums. I was working in the aquarium industry, and yeah, serviced ponds and wetlands, and it turned into like this big obsession. So I was working with different plants. So I used to have it so that I would plant out these aquariums for people, and this was a little side hustle. Did this while I was at uni, so I've always had my own little small business. And I'd plant the tanks in such a way that then there wouldn't be as much maintenance done because the plants would do all the work. And there used to be a little bit of a mode, which is kind of like that capitalist mode, where they would deliberately order in plants that would us like semi-aquatic, so they would sort of die. And so it would be like that thing where people had to come back to buy more, but I would always be like, no.
No, I don't need to do that.
You need to do this and this and this. But the thing is, I generated more work because they came in because they wanted the knowledge. And then I had all these amazing reoccurring customers that bought more. And I was like, kind of like proving that the model is just stupid. You know, you can do way more. And then what happened was it ignited a passion in people because then they felt confident in what they were doing. So they would come back in, they would buy more plants, they would upgrade their systems, they would get bigger and bigger and bigger because they got more passion because you're teaching.
I reckon you've maintained that ethos to today with the work that you do in garden design.
Yes. Cool. Well, it's kept going. Yeah. Well,
awesome.
The world, everything from what I've learned with aquariums was that most environments are like little aquariums.
Little mini.
You know, mini aquariums. You're playing kind of Mother Nature.
Yeah.
And all the little fine elements, you tip the balance, you change the hierarchies, the different type of fish, animals. It's all kind of
doing it at landscape scale.
That's right.
Yeah.
And then you also learn about the water ecologies and how important water is.
Yeah.
And, all those different things that can just tip the balance with water too, which is bacteria layers too, because there's bacteria in your water, bacteria in your air, bacteria in your soil.
In your gut.
In your gut. And it's all part of it, and you realise it. Mm.
The biota.
Oh, it's a big biota.
Greg, you're into biota, as in some of your mycology stuff. Microbiota?
Myco. I don't know. We just made that up.
Did you just make that up? shortest day of the year. What does that do for places like Forest Glade?
Well, it's been a really weird sort of season up there. It's so I do some work on a farm. And
you were saying on the side. So you work at a cattle farm as well as working at...
Yeah, so I do gardening there, but often it's just Trixie and I on a quad bike chasing cows from paddock to paddock.
That's nice.
Seasons, it still feels like autumn. Like the soil temperature is still quite high and like I've had saffron milk caps and slippery jacks growing underneath the pine trees at home just starting in the last few weeks.
And they would normally be...
And they would usually be earlier autumn.
Yeah, right.
Like as soon as it gets wet in autumn, they usually pop up.
Yeah.
And there's still, fungi everywhere. The soil temperature still seems to be quite warm.
Mm.
We can pull cows out of a paddock and 2 weeks later we can put them back in the same paddock because the grass is still growing. It's strange.
Did I hear that it was the warmest May...
Night, since, I think.
Yeah.
Was it? It was 13 degrees or something.
In documented history.
Yeah.
Felt tropical last week.
Yeah, it was 13 degrees. Like two, 3 days ago, it was 13 degrees low temperature at nighttime.
Mm.
The solstice swim, we do that every year. And normally the water can be sort of as low as 9.
Mm.
It was a balmy 12 or 13 yesterday. Mm.
Honestly, it's been really hard to keep track of all the warmest night in this warmest...
Yeah, warmest
day
this,
since this, warmest
that.
Month since that.
Wettest, windiest.
Yeah.
It's a thing, isn't it? Yeah.
It's almost like something's happening.
Yeah. Fair dinkum. Yeah, it is. So you were mentioning, like, we may hear the little gentle pitter-patter of Trixie the dog, but Trixie's a cattle dog.
Yeah.
And you were saying just in the green room before, she's actually getting to do some, not work, but she's
demonstrating.
She's working.
Yeah, she's working.
Yeah,
yeah, and she loves it. She's living her best life. So she still gets to go on forest adventures like all my other dogs have.
Yeah.
But yeah, she's bought a collie Kelpie cross, and she always used to get excited if she saw cows, even in the car or something. And now she gets to, you know, yip at them and try not to get kicked in the head.
Oh,
and,
careful.
And ride around on quad pikes with mud spraying up on us. And, yeah, no, she loves it. Rolling in cow poo.
Lovely.
Yeah.
Did you wash her? Because she's clean as a whistle.
She runs through wet grass a lot.
Is that
too,
right? So I'm like, she doesn't even smell like the dogs on the farm.
No.
And if you mention the word stinky, she'll get – I'm surprised she didn't lift her head up when I said it then. She's quite
sensitive about the word.
She's quite sensitive about the word stinky.
That's so funny. One of the staff has a dog, and she's really funny about – being yucky, like stinky and things too, and really it gets, you can almost see her just like, I am not.
I'm not.
Yeah.
Yeah, like she's some sort of like high-end British woman. I don't know. She's like, hello, like, look at her. Like, oh.
So it's the kind of nurture nature thing with Trixie. Like she's genetically wired to be a working dog.
Yeah.
She hasn't been a working dog.
She hasn't been a working dog. And then at 5 years old, as I say, occasionally she'd see them from the car, like we'd get stuck behind a herd of cattle getting pushed up one of the country roads or something, and she'd lose it, absolutely lose it. And, yeah, so now she gets to actually interact with these animals, and she's really good. Like, and because I spend so much time with her, she's good at voice commands and, like, she'll listen to what I'm saying and it's like she's been doing it since a puppy. I'm sure a real working dog is much more efficient than she is.
Yeah.
But for both of us not really being, you know, farmers,
yeah,
to all of a sudden being, you know, herding cattle around and moving them here and there, and she's quite really helpful. Like she makes the job a lot easier just because she knows how to sort of move them around and stuff. Yeah.
How wonderful. I love the fact that Trixie is living her best life. That's wonderful.
Oh, it's the best thing for the... Yeah.
Yeah.
I think if I can say one thing before I die is that I've given at least a couple of dogs a pretty good life. that's one tick on the box.
Well, that's a big tick. Good on you, Greg. It's wonderful. You're listening to the 3CR Garden Show. My name's John Arnott, joined today by Emmeline Bowman, Greg Balderston and Jay Iwasaki, ecologist, environmental advocate. We'll do a bit of a deep dive into some of the pollination work that we've been doing collectively as a group here. We do have a few community announcements. In fact, I should give out the numbers as well. So if you'd like to join in on any of the conversations that we're having this morning, feel free to jump on the phone and give us a call on 94190155. You can also text a question through or a comment to the 3CR text line, which is 0488 809 855. We do have a couple of community announcements, and the first of which are a couple of plugs for 3CR. As we talked about earlier, this year marks the 50th anniversary for 3CR as a station, and the station is in full celebration mode. So in a couple of Saturdays, Saturday the 4th of July, there's a 3CR 50th anniversary community event and celebration. It's 11 to 4 p.m. Saturday the 4th of July at Collingwood Town Hall. Basically all of the shows and all of the presenters are setting up tables and stalls there. So it's the 3CR community gathering in one place at Collingwood Town Hall. The gardening show will be there, so it's a great opportunity to meet some of the team. It'll be almost like a big extended garden clinic. You can bring a plant in if you want to identify it, and we can identify it. We don't have to do the description, you know, it's got five petals and it's pink type of thing. Meryl Johnson, she's going to be doing some seed sowing demonstrations as a part of that. So the garden show is going to be there. We've got a roster, a nice opportunity to come and ask some questions directly of the 3CR Garden Show team. But all of the shows will be attending. I think the Yarra Bike Bug, which is the bicycle user group, they're going to do a pop-up gardening bike maintenance workshop. And so it'll just be a lot of fun. But the gathering of the people behind 3CR, behind the microphones, behind all of the shows of 3CR –
All the people you'd want to bump into.
All the people you'd want to bump into. What a community of people.
Yeah.
I mean, just looking at the grid in here behind Jay.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's 24 hours of community sitting in that grid. So wonderful opportunity to come in, meet the 3CR community, and just celebrate this momentous occasion of 50 years on air for 3CR.
Could solve all the world's problems with this.
Yeah, well, it's all there. All the answers are in that grid.
Yeah,
you bet they are. I'm pretty sure you could just rock up in the day, but if you do register online, you go into the draw. So there's a door raffle. So register before the event at Humanitix. So if you type in Humanitix and 3CR Community Day, you'll have access to a link for that. So 50th anniversary community event, Saturday 4th of July, 11 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Collingwood Town Hall. Next Sunday. So the other thing which is happening at 3CR at the moment, the studio is in full radiothon mode. And next Sunday, the 28th of June, I think it is, is our 3CR radiothon show. Mm. So it's an extended show. So next week's show will start at 7:30, the usual time, and go through to 10 o'clock. And it's a wonderful opportunity for the listeners of the gardening show to help keep this vibrant gardening show 3CR community going. So it's a fundraising event. It's the only fundraising event that 3CR does through the year. It'll be the same format as previous years, where listeners can purchase this really interesting array of products, fertilizers, tools, nursery vouchers, all donated to the station by various businesses and individuals and organizations, and all of those proceeds from the sale go to supporting the station and the show. And on the back of some really successful tours and experiences that we had for last year's radiothon, we're repeating that again, but we're diversifying it a bit with a range of different tours. So, Greg, you're going to be running a tour of Forest Glade.
Yeah, so hopefully we'll try and do it in November when, like, the laburnum archway is flowering.
Beautiful.
And there's still rhodies and camellias out, and the garden's quite colourful at that time of the year.
Super.
Yeah, it's usually a nice. It's usually a bit quieter in spring there up there too. In autumn, it gets pretty hectic.
Yeah, sure.
But spring's a bit quieter and more enjoyable.
Peak autumn's gone. Is it still colour in the hills?
Funnily enough, there are still, even at my place, a couple of trees with autumn colour on them.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, it's because we just haven't had those cold nights.
Strange season.
Yeah.
So for the radiothon, Greg will be running a tour of Forest Glade. I'll read out a couple. Karen Sutherland's opening her garden, her urban food forest garden in Pascoe Vale. So an opportunity to walk around Karen's garden. If anyone listened to the show a couple of weeks ago, Karen is an absolute authority on produce, food forests. You know, an extraordinary garden. Mm. So it's a permaculture-based garden, opportunity to go and see Karen's garden, walk through the garden. She's going to do some herbal teas and a whole bunch of things. There's going to be a tour of the Melton Botanic Garden. Melton Botanic Garden being a really interesting, if you're interested in small eucalypts or mallee eucalypts, get along to the Melton Botanic Garden. Forest Glade that we mentioned, Heronswood down at Dramana, the digger's property. We've snagged a tour opportunity, a guided tour opportunity for a tour of the Heronswood Garden. Cloud Hill, Jeremy's going to open up Cloud Hill and run a private tour. Etc. Craig Castry, he's very involved with the Werribee Park Heritage Orchard, and he's going to be doing a fruit tree pruning masterclass. So you can buy tickets to a fruit tree pruning masterclass with Craig Castry, and those funds come back to support the station. So, next week, radiothon, an extended show, 7:30 to 10 o'clock. Tune in. A whole range of really interesting products and interesting tours, and every cent that gets raised goes to support the 3CR Gardening Show.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
It's cool.
Yeah,
go another 50 years.
Yeah, keep it going. Keep it going for another 50 years. Just on Craig Castry, on the 9th of August there's a winter heritage fruit tree festival down at Werribee Park Farm. That's Sunday the 9th of August, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. Free. It's a free event, and you know, there's opportunities to learn all things heritage fruit trees, and there's fruit tree and scion sales, talks, preserves, tastings, crafts, demonstration, talk stores, exhibitors. So put that in your diary for Sunday, the 9th of August, 2026, Werribee Park Farm, the Heritage Fruit Tree Festival. And just this week, it's not a community announcement so much, but there is a new guide to the Eucalypts of Melbourne, which has just been published. It's the ACE, A-C-E. Or maybe it's ACE as in really, really good. I'm not really sure whether that's an acronym or it's just a really cool guide to eucalypts. It's a pocket-sized field guidebook designed to help people identify eucalypts across the greater Melbourne area. Practical field guide to 36 eucalypt species found in greater Melbourne. Written by Vicky Shukuruglu. Shukuruglu. Do you know Vicky?
I don't know. No. I was like, have you? No.
And Rod Fensom. And basically it's a field guide. It's a hands-on guide to identifying Melbourne's eucalypts. It covers a whole bunch of stuff. Identification, habitat, ecology, classification, First Nations knowledge and relationships with eucalypts, and you know where to find these in Melbourne's parks and gardens.
I need this. Yeah. Eucalypts are intimidating.
They are, aren't they?
Even I agree. Like, there's so many, I find it hard to.
Me too. Me too. So yes, there it is. Yeah. So it's the ACE guide to Melbourne's eucalypts. You can pick up a copy, you can purchase a copy at eucalyptsmelbourne.com.au/buy.
I want one.
Yeah. So that's pretty cool. Chloe mentioned that. Chloe Foster mentioned that to me during the week.
I was about to say, I bet you she knows them too. She knows everyone. Oh,
she's a bit of a networker, that Chloe.
I know.
Yeah, she's doing really great.
She helps me too with names. Get lost.
Of plants. Of people.
I'm very good at facial recognition, but not names. Sorry, forgot your name, Jay.
just something has come in here about Trixie. Hi, lovelies and Trixie. Any advice for condition? Oh, this is not necessarily related to Trixie, but it's just an acknowledgement that she's in the studio.
Oh.
Any advice for conditions for a porcelain berry and smooth-leased russ, as I've rebought them after killing them both last year? This is David in Upway. Does anyone know what a porcelain berry is?
Well, the only thing I know is a porcelain berry thing is a Ampelopsis, which is a grape relative, a climber.
Yeah, yep.
So I'm not sure if that's a problem with the common names, I guess, isn't it?
Let's go with that, though. I reckon that's so, porcelain berry is pretty specific.
Yeah. So that what I know as is Ampelopsis brevipedunculatus. Brevipedunculatus.
Encyclopedia, is it?
Just,
they're the only amazing names I can remember, too.
Oh, you're amazing. Greg.
People names, no idea. Yeah. Plant names in the pocket.
I'd probably get them wrong as well. But it's a very vigorous climber, usually. Almost to the point where you have to be careful where you plant it, like you would with an ornamental grape or a wisteria.
Because of its vigour.
It's quite vigorous and can, if you plant it in a hard spot to prune or to look after, it can get away from you quite quickly.
Okay.
Beautiful autumn colour, sort of a soft buttery yellow. And then as they're colouring up in autumn, the fruit on it, which are like small clusters of grapes, they sort of start off a greeny yellow and end up sort of turning blue and purple.
Okay.
So it's like, and they, on closer inspection, it looks like someone's painted, you know, like an antique porcelain where you sort of get little speckles and things through the colouring of it. So they look like little painted purple and blue porcelain berries.
Okay. So that's why it's got the name.
Hence the common name.
Yeah.
Mm.
So what was the, was there a question with them?
Just advice on growing it. So what's its cultural requirements? How should David approach it?
I think with most climbers, by their nature, they like generally being planted in a shadier, cooler spot, but to grow up into the light.
Okay.
If you think about how most climbers would grow in the wild,
cool roots.
They're down in the forest floor and they're growing up to the canopy or up into the sunlight. That's their niche,
yep.
I guess.
Yeah.
I'd say they're like grapes. They're quite hardy, so you don't need to water them, although the first couple of years you'd want to get them established. But yeah, they're generally pretty easy to grow, the Ampelopsis.
Okay.
And maintenance, though.
The maintenance is the big thing. Once, as I say, if you've got a huge area and you can just let it go, it's fine. But if you've got a small space and it's hard to prune in that area, it's going to be a bit tricky because they can grow quite vigorously,
It's the sort of thing that might smother small shrubs and trees?
Smother big trees.
Big trees, yeah, okay.
Or medium-sized trees,
So it's a proper liana.
Yeah, it's I've got one. Well, I had one dominating. I like throwing four or five vigorous things together and see who wins. And for quite a few years, Ampelopsis was beating the wisteria and the other thing I had there? Parthenocissus henryana.
Mm. Wow.
It was clouting out both of those quite easily. And then for some reason there was a shift and now the wisteria's winning. So, it's quite vigorous.
Yeah.
It's quite vigorous. Don't put it in expect you can easily keep it to a couple of square metres. It wants to be big.
Okay.
Yeah.
Tom, who works with us, he used to work in maintenance and he always said with the vines and like with the vitis, is it, you keep a central leading stem and you try and maintain that and then clean off anything. Is it similar to that you have?
I think you could grow it the same way.
Yeah.
As I say, the Parthenocissus are also grape relatives as well in the same family. All of those, if you can cut back to, and the wisteria too, I guess.
Yeah,
too,
they say for wisteria, just keep that main one central stem and you can have little bits if you want to train onto other, but try and maintain the one so you've got control of it rather than it going crazy.
Yeah, going everywhere.
Yeah, but that was a good way he used to teach.
Certainly,
it.
If you want to control it, you're looking at a hard prune like that every year.
Every year.
Cutting it back to that,
to
those central sort of main shoots.
Leaders,
And I'm not very good with that sort of maintenance work.
It gets away really quick. Like a vine can get away really quickly.
Yeah. And like I had ornamental grapes up the front of my house to the point where, there was a half a metre of dead sticks and branches sort of stuck in the middle of this thing because you couldn't get at it from any side. The only way you could sort of get at it was from underneath.
Right.
And it was like being indoors. It was like being in a cave underneath this thing because it was years of dense sort of thing. So it ended up
almost composting.
The leaves get caught in it and the possum poo gets caught in it and all sorts. And then, it's quite a fire risk too when you've got a lot of that dried sort of dead material up off the ground. So, cutting them back each year is probably a good thing, especially if it's close to the house or those sorts of things.
Yep.
But as I say, I like letting things grow and see what they do.
the survival of the strongest.
Yeah. And I don't mind a prune either. So if they do get out of hand, you can literally cut it back down to chest height or ground level and it'll come back.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Terrific. Well, I hope that was helpful, David. My name's John Arnott. Today, just listening to the 3CR Garden Show. Today, I'm joined by Emmeline Bowman, Greg Balderston, and Jay Iwasaki. Again, we'd love listeners to jump in to any of the conversations that we're having. Put a question through to the phone line here, which is 94190155. And feel free to text a question through on 0488 809 855. We've got a very well-credentialed panel this morning to actually be discussing things around pollinators and urban ecology and stuff like that. So, Jay, your area of expertise is a sort of a bee ecologist, and your studio focuses on biodiversity, habitat creation, those types of things.
And being crazy.
Greg, you're...
I wander around the forest. But you're
an observer of natural systems.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, I'd consider you a naturalist without, getting your gear off and all that sort of stuff. But, you're a person that is, very in tune with natural systems and you make observations.
I pay attention to stuff, for sure, yeah.
So, I think we're in a really nice position to be exploring a whole bunch of stuff around wildlife gardens and planting for pollinators and pollinator corridors, and that's one of your portfolios, one of your aims, at council, is to be doing work in that space.
As a councillor for Brunswick, green space is a premium, and we want to encourage that and bring as much greenery back to the inner city, inner north, Marybeck as possible.
Yep. And what does that look like on the ground?
Well, it means encouraging residents to plant more things,
yeah,
and planting specific things too, and teaching people what's good, what's beneficial, what we really need more than just grass, really.
Yeah,
it's such a big thing just to tear out concrete. It's so expensive. It's so hard to get green back once you take it out.
Yeah, and it disappears incrementally over,
you know, yeah,
death by a thousand cuts thing.
Yes, one tree at a time,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, sure is.
So, yeah, encouraging and funding especially, getting residents to take care of nature strips, encouraging residents to plant their own nature strips, and getting the community involved,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah, for sure. Are there design principles that are in play around planting for wildlife?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
You want to talk to some of those?
Sure. Everything can obviously be habitat, and you can change, like, the way a garden would be in the hierarchies in order to attract certain wildlife.
Yep.
So, say if you wanted a diverse garden, you had quite a big space, and you wanted to have a really good balance of what wildlife comes in. And we're talking holistically, so yep, it could be from lizards to different types of bees to different types of bird species to mammals. So what we try and do is we try and have a little bit of open space.
Mm-hmm.
The open space could have some, like, native grasses if you want that to be a lawn, or if you have, like, large boulders and things like that. And that sort of attracts all of your reptile species. Grasses itself attract granivores, which are your seed-eating species. And then when you go into the next layer, you're going into sort of like your flowering shrub mass. And if you can get that, that's what starts to attract your small birds.
Yep.
And that's really probably the most important, especially in Melbourne, because we tend to prioritise more tree species. And so what that means is that you have, like, open parklands and tree species. So that's why you get more of those, so, you know, bully birds, they say.
Advantage.
Their advantage.
Noisy miners, advantage, yeah, magpies, advantage.
All of them. All of those, yeah, things, yeah. Because if you imagine, because they're bullies, and this is my thing I just say, is, like, a bully will be able to see you around the corner and, you know, thump you. So if you have big trees out, the bullies in the trees are waiting for the losers, and they're going to freaking pump them, you know? That's what it's,
yeah. I feel attacked. I've been swooped by a noisy miner.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, so we want to have a really dense shrub mass.
So close it up.
Close it up. But we still do need a tree, because, yep, then we need a predatory species. Because, you know, you can get lizards and snakes and all those sort of little things get out of hand, and you want to be able to have it where you've got a spot where they can sort of watch, observe, and get some food. So if you had a garden, and it might even just be a small garden, it might even be a balcony garden.
Yeah, okay.
You can still attract pollinators and even sometimes birds. So we are always under the notion of balconies, try and get a wicking bed. Because,
okay,
wicking beds tend to work a lot better, because sometimes balconies are really exposed to elements.
Yeah, can dry out quickly.
Exactly. Mm. So then if you've got this little reservoir at the bottom of your planter, you can put different plant species in there. And, you know, prioritising species that have pollinating attracting qualities. So you can still use exotics, but, you know, we love using natives. But, you know, for exotics, salvias are really good. But with your native species, you know, you can go for all your daisies, dampieras,
yep,
scavolas. We do
beautiful, pretty, gorgeous garden plants in their own right.
That's right. And then you can still create these beautiful flower-rich balconies that start to bring in insects. It can bring in, you know, it's crazy. It can bring even in lizards, like your marbled geckos, which are here in Melbourne. You'll find that you get marbled geckos in your balconies.
Lizards can also be pollinators.
And they are, exactly.
Hang on. Yeah. That's extraordinary. Just could you say that again, Jay?
Oh, lizards are also important pollinators in a lot of places, especially in New Zealand.
How did I not know that? I'm not sure I knew that.
It's a closely guarded secret.
So what sort of things would lizards be pollinating?
Oh, well, I mean, pollination is just transferring, you know, pollen around. Sure. So if you're
just rubbing on a flower and moving to the next one.
Yeah, sure.
If there's a reason for it, they'll do it.
Yeah. Yeah.
They may not be super efficient, but they get the job done.
Mm. Yeah. It's interesting. I mean, I think what you're talking about there is structure.
It is structure and layers.
Structure and layers. Yeah. So if you think of a footy ground, I mean, that's habitat for some things, but it's inherently simple. It's grass, it's open, there's no shrubs, there's no...
And diversity.
If you let that that oval grow, so the grasses are big, it'd be habitat for, you know, a bunch of butterflies, because larval food plants, it's cover for little things. If you planted some trees into that, there's more complexity and it's a niche for other things.
Yeah.
Putting some shrubs into that.
And you always want to provide for nectivores.
Nectivores,
nectar eaters.
Yep.
Granivores, seed eaters.
Grain eaters.
Insectivores, insect eaters.
Yep.
And frugivores, fruit eaters.
Frugivores.
There's so they'll be
there
like,
is a new term.
Yeah, so fruit eaters. So that'd be like your, you know, your fruit bats. Many species of birds. I've seen butcher birds just gobble down Dianella berries.
Yeah, right.
So if you can maintain these four different groups, so you've got seed producing plants.
Yep. So fruit examples being
all the grasses.
Native grasses.
So native grasses.
Wattles?
Yeah, some wattles when they start to do their seed pods. Yep. So, usually it's more grass. That's why you usually see like corellas and, you know, and galahs on the ground because they're picking up all the little seeds.
Mm. Yeah, right.
Frugivores will be like, you know, Caprosma quadrifolia, the, what's the common
prickly currant?
Prickly currant berry, thank you. Dianellas, different types of pittosporums, which you were seeing. This is why they get moved around. And this is why you get a lot of, like, you know, weed things, sort of like your blackberries. But
the bird lollies.
Yeah, they're the bird lollies. Mm. But, the prickly currant bush is a really, really good one for, attracting those small birds. And it's prickly. It's for the little ones. They can get these little red bellies. Berries and you can eat them as well.
Yeah, sure.
You can actually train that plant as well if you shrub them.
Make they it a can garden get a plant.
Bit, yeah, because it can get a bit unruly.
Yep.
Insectivores would be like, they actually come from a lot of the flowers and flowering species because you're bringing in insects, but it's also coming in your mulch layers. So if you can increase your natural mulch layer, you'll get
soil biota.
That's right. Yeah, that's where it
fungi.
Yeah.
And the fungi.
Yeah, fungi.
Yep. Yeah. And that will get all that in. Yeah.
You've constantly got to remember, especially with gardening, even though it's a contrived idea that you've planted these things that they might not actually really belong, but whatever, you're still trying to replicate an ecology.
Mm.
Yeah.
And the ecology includes the water, the soil, the air, the whole habitat that you've planted those things in. It's the more you can replicate that by diversity, the better off, you know, that system will work.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And you can make them very beautiful because a lot of people think, I get people saying to me, I don't want it to look like a zoo or a native reserve. And I'm like, oh, God, I know.
Yeah, right.
And
really?
Then, yeah, I get
people,
that a lot.
People say that.
Oh, yeah. Mm. So, you know, if you look at our gardens, you'll notice that, like, we still use the same principles. You'll still see rocks and logs, but, you know, maybe our rocks have, like, a few, you know, naturally placed rocks and boulders, and then we'll saw the top off one so it becomes, like, a seat.
Yeah, right.
So it becomes this, like, interaction between, like, built and humans and animals, and then, you know, you'd have your grasses come up as these beautiful ornamental things, but then, you know, that becomes the habitat to the skinks and it provides the seeds. And then you have, like, all your shrub mass behind and your trees. You can still create this functional garden for humans, but in a way that still provides and the something wildlife.
It doesn't mean it's not unkempt. It can still be beautiful.
Absolutely. Mm. And you can still have, you know, your little pond and that provides the water source and make it so you've got all, you know, and then that provides for your frogs, but you've got this beautiful pond, you know, it's like, or a soak, you know, do a depression in the ground where the water can sort of start to pool and then soak back into the ground and the plants can absorb that. But at the same time, it provides little puddles for all your animals as well. So, yeah.
Niche and complexity.
Yes.
We talk about pollinators in Australia and, you know, we often just think about European honeybees. But there's much more than that, isn't there? There's the European honeybees are the... Some people refer to them as feral bees.
Yeah, they're feral honeybees. Well, you have your European honeybees in a hive and then the ones that escape that become feral.
Yep.
Okay.
But yeah, I always start about bees by talking about how We have so many native species, over 2,000 potentially.
Species of native bee.
Of native bee that people are just not aware of.
Wow.
And I think one of the callers had a question about New Zealand bees too, because that was one of my questions when I was doing my PhDs. Do we have native bees in New Zealand? Yes, of course. Not as many as Australia, but the Australian bee fauna is very old, very very diverse, very cool. A lot of unique species, yeah. Unique groups even.
Yeah.
We have some of the smallest bees in the world that are ridiculously, like absurdly small.
As in, how small is absurdly small?
Like I'm holding up my fingers, no one can see, but like very, very small.
Like a millimeter.
Three mils max, something like that.
Wow. Yeah, and yeah, you don't typically see them in the numbers that you see honeybees in, and they're not as abundant year-round. So they are very seasonal. They are seasonally abundant, but they're there. And if you walk around, even on a lot of introduced plants, you'll see them. You'll see a small black waspy-looking thing, or I think people recognize blue-banded bees.
Yep. Yep.
Those are a minority of what the bee fauna is like. Most of the bees are smaller, medium size. Nondescript, but when you start looking at them up close, very cool.
But the blue-banded bees might be the charismatic.
That's right. Good charismatic species.
Yeah, for sure. So European bees, do they displace habitat?
That was part of my research, actually. And there is, it's an open question in some places, like are there actually enough floral resources when honeybees are collecting all that nectar? That are they actually competing? And in some cases, yes, that's been part of the research. And in some cases, there hasn't been clear links. One interesting situation in my PhD in New Zealand was that native New Zealand bees, 20, 30 species of them, don't actually collect a lot of nectar because they're not producing honey. They are making a ball of pollen with nectar that they feed to their larvae, and that's like their whole life cycle. Honeybees, on the other hand, are collecting mostly honey to make nectar to make honey for this winter store. So the plants that are really good at creating nectar were actually a lot of the European species, like clover, especially clover. And the native species are the ones that are producing more pollen and less nectar. So it's one of those clear things where they're not directly competing, but at the same time, we've lost a lot of habitat in New Zealand to pasture, introduced clover. Mm-hmm. So they may not be competing, but the amount of bees, native bees in New Zealand has dropped dramatically because of loss of habitat.
Yeah, so that's about viable habitat rather than competition.
Right, yeah.
Did New Zealand ever have, buzz pollinators like the blue-banded bee? Because the bumblebee was going to be introduced into mainland Australia before they...
Yeah.
So is there any buzz pollinators?
Not that I'm aware of. I could be wrong. But of the main species, they're mostly very... For New Zealand flowers, anyway, they're mostly generalist open flowers.
Yeah.
Nothing like tomatoes or something with the slit pollen... Yeah. Thing going on.
So buzz pollination.
Oh, yeah.
It's a phenomenon.
Mm. Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, it's where the bee vibrates.
Yeah, vibrates its body.
Frequency. Yeah, at 300, the head actually vibrates 300 times per second. That's how fast it is. And it causes the plant to, release its pollen.
It's super cool, because there's two types of, bumblebees do buzz pollination, but also blue-banded bees do buzz pollination. And a bee flaps its wings at about 200-300 beats per second, which is incredible.
Come on, that's ridiculous.
And hummingbird, for example, is about 60 hertz. So by vibe, they disconnect their actual wings. They don't flap their wings. They just vibrate the muscles.
Yeah.
And that gets the pollen coming out of the slits. And for tomatoes is a classic example, in bumblebees, just the right frequency to, get that out. My actual lab mate, Colin, I forgot your last name, Colin. It's been 10 years, went to Adelaide Botanic Gardens from Harvard and filmed these blue-banded bees with high-speed cameras, and I think that was part of his research, like seeing that these blue-banded bees are actually banging their heads against the flowers. is it possible, their own version.
Is it possible for us to find some of that footage?
And, it should be. Yeah, yeah, it should be on YouTube.
Because we might upload some of that to the Facebook page. Yeah, well, the socials. Years ago, I heard about this buzz pollination thing, and I got a tuning fork and banged it and stuck it underneath a Dianella flower.
Oh.
And poof, the pollen was, it was absolutely extraordinary.
Oh, how fascinating. What
a but that's a phenomenon.
Mm.
So there's no, things like Dianella and buzz pollinating things, there's no, is there a nectar reward for the, or is it really just about they get attracted by the colour and there's no, there's a pollen reward?
There could, I mean.
Well, it'd be more pollen.
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
I mean, nectar, you know, nectar reward, pollen reward, it's just to get the bees to visit, right?
Yeah.
Or to get a pollinator to visit, not just bees, and to get things moving. So if, you know, they've got a really good quality pollen source, then maybe nectar's not a big deal.
We hear about decline in, you know, invertebrate numbers and, you know, something's reaching, you know, critically low. You know, why should we care about that?
Well, yeah, it's kind of like the building blocks of a garden. You know, you've got to start from the bottom up, and in ecology, a lot of the building blocks of every other bit of wildlife, birds, mammals, everything, are the insects that they eat. So part of the reason we want good pollinator corridors is to get those insects there to feed the birds. And then we have a beautiful place to live. And I guess, you know, what is the value? I mean, this is always the thing, like, you know, this one bird species is troubling a coal mine, you know? Yeah. Why does that matter?
Why does that matter?
Well, everything matters in having a healthy ecology that we can live in and have our needs met with resources and clean air and clean water. We can just build things to take care of it, which is vastly more expensive, but also like a deprivation of all the things that we care about. And I think that people intrinsically love. Getting into philosophy, sorry.
No, this is good. We've got plenty of time to do a deep dive here.
And it's also that thing is like 96% of the mammal and animal mass on this planet are humans and livestock. 4% that's left and remaining are our wild animals.
Wow.
And 75% of all bird species are actually chicken and broiler farms.
Wow.
Right.
Did you know that?
No, I did not know that. That's extraordinary.
Yeah. And then... Yeah,
And that you've just described
it's a monoculture,
a worldwide monoculture.
Yeah. That's why
when they talk about extinction level events and things like that, there's plenty of life on Earth.
Yeah,
it's just getting fewer and fewer species. The diversity is struggling, and when something happens, like climate change. If you've lost a lot of that diversity, that's going to impact the whole world, like the whole life cycle on Earth dramatically, because there's not as much resistance for it anymore because we've knocked out so many species.
Mm. Yeah. That diversity is keeping, you know, the whole web supported. You lose one, it's okay. You lose another, it's okay. Mm. At some point, it's so simplified that you can have complete collapse.
Yeah. Ecological collapse. Yeah. You mentioned pollinator corridors. There's Emma Cutting and people like that are doing some work on, you know, actual physical corridor. Mm. Is that the sort of thing that you're
absolutely working on? Emma Cutting is such a great example of someone who in the community took it upon themselves to get started and build something really impressive. I love Emma. I love chatting with Emma and going down to South Melbourne to see what she's done and trying to, I wish we had an Emma Cutting in Marybeck. It is so much work, though. She's done an amazing amount of personal work and energy to create that sustaining community. And, of course, everybody who's worked with her is getting that.
That's what's infectious.
Yeah. That. And, I mean, the knowledge base that they've accumulated and what they've done is hard to replicate, but something we should all look towards.
Does Gardens for Wildlife... does that replicate that at a municipal scale? Is that
it does? But the resources of a council are surprisingly small. You know, there's about 1,000 employees total.
Yeah,
And I think the volunteer base for like a gardening project like the South Melbourne, like the Melbourne Pollinator Corridor in South Melbourne, you know, it's got to be in at least 100 people who are contributing. Probably more. There's 200 gardens, I think, so far. Mm. So just getting that.
In the Polano Corridor?
Mm, yeah, down in South Melbourne.
And that, is that mostly nature strips or not?
Yeah, they've done some interesting things because I've asked a lot of questions about how can we actually get our city to turn some of these concrete sidewalks greener because it's so expensive to cut out the asphalt.
Yeah, sure. Just the cost of undoing that.
Yeah, that's right. And so we're trying to avoid putting in as much concrete in the first place when there's a street that's being redone. And, you know, sometimes Melbourne Water may be doing it and they put in the concrete because they're not coordinating with the city, so it's counterproductive. But we've got to just coordinate better. A lot of things she's done to avoid that are building raised beds on top of the concrete.
Yeah, sure.
But then, yeah, there's watering issues and drainage. And they've picked their species to work
to,
with that.
To suit to that, those conditions, yeah.
It's tough too because you're dealing with different people. And I find, like, when I'm working, is there's people who aren't necessarily on board.
Some people who get it and some people who don't?
Yeah. And that's always, because then you get all, like, you know, when you're doing community consultation and there's always a few people that, you know, think that these things are going to bring snakes or, you know, so it's always about, like, it's a slow burn where we have to slowly educate people. I know it's really annoying to slowly educate.
But no, it's my profession.
Yeah, that's your profession. I just get like, I'm like, no, we need to do it now. But no, I also love to educate.
No, I know what you mean.
But it is part of that. But there is that thing where within Melbourne, and what gets me a little bit like frustrated is, you know, Melbourne is so fantastic where we have all these great initiatives and, you know, we're rolling out things that give people the opportunities to educate themselves and understand that. But then as soon as we get out of Melbourne, there's new suburbs being built and they don't replicate any of these principles. In fact, they have the opportunity to do so and it's a completely the opposite.
And that's where I'm frustrating.
Yes, yeah, so frustrating. And then what happens is we get this bubble within cities and it's in the cities. So you get amazing congregation of people who have the knowledge. And as soon as we go out where there actually should be more biodiversity and thought about our local ecosystems.
Oh, it's easier to do there too. Like they're building it from scratch so they can actually incorporate it from the beginning.
Way easier. And then they don't. Like we literally just got a project and I was like, I feel so sick about it. But like at the same time, like what can we do to help it? So we had this company, or is that council actually? It's council down near Newborough. They're just creating a new estate there. Same thing. Like they could have. I wish they would have engaged us to be able to be part of like the parks and all that. But they only got us to do the reserve. In this reserve, they already had approval, and they didn't want to listen to us about like trying to retain the gully. So there was a gully on here because of the people that are on this area. They decided to turn it into a gross pollutant trap, which just means that they're going to bulldoze that gully and just put a trap, a water trap, so it just all goes into this thing.
So do that engineering thing.
Yep. And they also say you don't need to retain any of the trees when there were mature eucalypts on there. They're going to bulldoze them all, and then they're going to flatten that whole area, put gravel down, and then just put a little parkland, and then they put all these houses down the street, and it's like in a quite a significant area. So when we took on the project, the only thing we're trying to do, because they've already like we're not going to keep the gully, it's though here you'd have to, so the only thing we can do is be like push them to be able to retain the significant trees and even the old like stumps that are there, and it's the only thing we can do. And this is where I'm like, we're here in 2026 with all the knowledge and all these councils in these massive areas and with people, and it's ignorance.
And this wicked dilemma, which is in front of our eyes.
It's intentional ignorance too.
It's intentional.
Because it makes some money.
That's right. It's institutional. Like Marybeck had a really good, this is part of like the wider problem, is just the lack of knowledge that you guys have in different levels of government. So on council that I've been, you know, part of in Marybeck, we had these great townhouse standards even that had incorporated trees when they're brought in. But the new, there's all these state level reforms and activity center reforms and planning reforms that take away the local say in it, which in some cases is, you know, fine with me, because it's like there are cases that have been these I guess obstacles to getting housing in that have been
Freed up?
Freed up, because, you know, we are in a housing crisis, and it's really insignificant. And the lack of density in a lot of places has been a product of not necessarily good faith, right? So the state has taken a lot of things out of council control, and a lot of that were some of our good environmental initiatives that we put into. And it's just not a priority, or it's just not something that people are aware of, maybe, when they put in these things. A lot of the issues that I face on council, can I do this? Can I do that? No, it meets the state minimum requirements.
Yeah.
I can't ask them to put in 6 more bike racks. I can't ask them to put another tree. It's completely up to the developer. And the state, but, you know, the developer ultimately is the one designing.
Well, it's
the
developer, isn't it? Because they're paying the state to do whatever they want to do anyway.
You're listening to the 3CR Garden Show. On the panel today is Emmeline Bowman, Greg Balderston and Jay Iwasaki. If you'd like to jump into this conversation, or if you've got any questions about gardening or a garden question, feel free to call in on 49419-0155. And you could also text a question or a comment through to the text line, which is 0488-809-855. And we've got a lovely text message which has come in here from Di saying, I'm getting a new garden design with Emmeline and the STEM team. One thing we want to do is to create a home for bees, especially the burrowing ones. What do you think about depth, fill, material, aspect? So I reckon that's a question to Jay. Yeah. Oh
my God, I've been dreading this question. I've been dreading this question.
Why?
Because I don't know. Well, mainly because it's actually quite, it's very specific. So depends on your bees.
So the question is about creating habitat for burrowing bees and how you do that.
It's a big question.
It's more about soil.
So if you want a specific kind of bee, you got to kind of know what's in your area.
Yeah.
And then you got to know... There's, you know, many types of burrowing bees. If you want sandy, if you want et cetera. So first thing you need to do is a bee survey. Kind of see what you have.
See what you have. Or could you go to something like...
you could do more general techniques,
So we know... very lovely to work with Di on her garden. But because this is in Northcote, you know, you tend to know your soils around Northcote. We have got real sandy loam, and especially where Di is. Though the soils do change because of building. Sometimes they'll, you know, when they do that with houses, they'll move all the soil. So there is a bit of that. So what we want to do is we still want to mimic the existing soil ecologies if we can. And it's also about what we plant back. But for your burrowing species, like a lot of our solitary bees are looking for those sandy loams or the fissures that are found in like bits of clay and stuff like that. You do see that as well. But what we tend to do is the sandy loam soil, you can bank it up as like little tiny mounds around boulders and things like that, and they tend to do that. Another little thing that we've done with Di's garden is... we've actually created little bee homes, but we did it in the brickwork that sits below her greenhouse. So we've got these little openings that we've designed, and the bricks will have, we're going to put different types. So some of them will just be open voids.
Yep.
And then we'll put a sandy sort of clay mud mortar.
Like a render?
Yeah, but we're going to actually fill that whole thing in and then put holes in that.
Okay.
And then we're going to get normal bricks, which are just going to have the, you know, how they usually have the internal hollows exposed, or those holes exposed.
The 3 holes or the 5 holes.
Yeah, so we'll have them, and then we're going to put like all the different types of nesting material and stick material. So it'll be bits of, you know, eucalypts that have had holes drilled, or it could be bamboo, it could be bits of hay, it can be cut bits of rushes. And then it's always about then what is happening externally from the garden. So if you've got your sandy soils and then you're introducing different plant species to be able to attract different types of insect, pollinating insect species, that's what we do.
Okay.
And then you get all of that through. So that's just one example.
Bees can do, they can live in weird places. Like some of the most interesting places that we've done research has been in orchards. And one of the biggest nesting aggregations was where the tractors were driving over all the time, which is not where you expect it.
Really
compacted soils. And then, I've seen bees just nesting in one patch of lawn in Dunedin in New Zealand. And this one species, it's like, this is where you go to find them. There's a lot all over, you know, the suburb, but there's this one spot. It's a little bit of a slope. It's exactly the same lawn.
And they were burrowing into the soil?
Yeah, just burrowing in the grass. Right. So it can be unexpected. It can be based on a history of where they've been and have built a population. Sometimes they come back to the same general area. Just, you got to think like a bee, and nobody knows what bees are thinking.
Okay.
I mean, yeah, a little bit, but it's some weird ones.
You go to a garden centre, the big box garden centre, and you'll see these things called bee hotels.
Mm.
Do they work?
It depends. So I would be very careful about them where they're coming in from overseas, like the timbers, and you don't know how they've been treated. It's very targeted to certain species as well. So it'd be like what your reed bees, the mud dawbler. Is it mud dawbler? And
yeah, and if you... Yeah, if you see the ones that are mostly, like, commercial with the really big bamboo, like the huge bamboo, it's like nothing is nesting in that.
No.
You want to mimic what's here.
A spider. A huntsman will be
there. Yeah, spiders do like them.
Something will occupy
it. Insects, yeah, for spiders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We used to have where it was very interesting when you're working on wetlands, the rush species would attract so many bee and wasp species, because if you open rushes, you'll find that they're little hollow segments. And they'll have like almost inside, they have segments kind of like bamboo.
Yeah.
And what would happen is the wasp or bee species will inject their larvae in there and would live inside.
Inside the reed.
Inside the reed. And then, you know, that would then let it out and then it would do its thing. So it's a bit like why bamboo is good and like, or and then the really thin bits, because it kind of mimics that in a way. So it is mimicking what is there.
Yeah.
But yeah, but when we do bug hotels or whatever, try and use like, you know, your local things, like and use your curled up bits of bark from mana gums or you know, old grass materials and
your reed own bees mud. Reeds. Reed bees are like, if you think of the size of a raspberry stem or something, because they also nest in blackberry raspberry stems.
Do that really?
That's the kind of the size you're thinking.
Okay. So pencil thick, maybe a bit thicker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Even smaller.
Smaller.
Pencil or smaller.
Pencil or smaller. Pencil. Okay. And are those commercial bee hotels big enough? Or, you know, because some of them are like 30 by 30 centimetres.
I mean, it depends. Like, I've seen them working in some areas and some not.
Yeah, okay.
I love that answer too. That's exactly right.
It's very hard. I'm sorry. It's not really specific.
No, that's okay.
It is, like, I notice, you know, if I'm down at our place in the Yarra Valley, we get a lot more activity because obviously the environment type lends itself to having more species available that want to use the home and utilise it. In Melbourne, your species selection might be a little bit more limited, so you probably don't get as much interaction, but you might find that you get a different interaction. It could be more spiders or... ants or just different, or slaters, and, you know, it could be different type of interaction. So, you know, it doesn't necessarily need to be that it needs to attract bees. You know, sometimes it's actually creating habitat for insects anyway.
Yeah, sure.
I think that's still important. Do you see a lot of, obviously you would see on your observations all different types of bee interaction at Forest Glade, and or do you ever see native
species? Well, as far as the forest goes, I'm often out there at nighttime.
There are some. But there's nighttime things. Pollination with all your moth species.
You do... I see lots of spiders in the forest at nighttime. I don't know how much pollinating they're doing. There's some interesting species of those.
Yeah.
Mount Macedon's funny... The native forest up there is funny because it is such a small area and so a lot of it's like cool climate rainforest, but it's not the same cool climate rainforest as like in the huge areas around Gippsland and stuff where there's not as much diversity. It's much – and the animals even more so. So
a bit more silent.
The insects and animals and birds, there's a lot less of those on this little island habitat.
Yeah.
So it is a weird one like that. There's always plenty of bees around, depending on the season and what's in flower. And
as in honeybees,
In honeybees,
yeah.
But we do get I get blue banded bees at home that nest in the ground and little mud wasps and I don't need to buy a little bee hotel from Bunnings because I just got crap everywhere.
I mean, that is one of the principles of wildlife gardening, is to leave some area of your garden and don't touch them at all.
I'd say leave every area in your garden as much as you can. Why not? It's like we were saying before, if you've got a lawn, and I know lawns can be really useful, and if there's any way you can introduce diversity into your lawn, do it. Even if it's just daisies. Like, you know, even if it's just some other plant that's not just the grass that, just lawns are the biggest waste of, it's still green, so it's better than concrete or bitumen, but it's still a wasteland. Like, it's still a habitat wasteland.
Is it true? I mean, I keep hearing this, and I like the idea that lawns are just a way to show off that you can waste space.
Yeah, well, it comes from like Versailles and play. You know, these huge elite gardens from, you know, previous times that we still think the pinnacle of gardening is having these, you know, trimmed hedges and perfectly cut lawns, and everything's tidy and in order, and you know, you've got 5 different plants across 10 acres, and that's
still,
it.
And it's still the same because, you know, people will get certain designers in and there's a certain look of a garden that will basically show your affluence. It's not about, you know, the most richest people are going to go for the most sterile garden.
And that's about thing. Control. That's about control, and it's about...
Yeah. And I guess it's control, it's... I actually don't know what it is.
But
it blows my mind. It doesn't make sense in my poor little brain.
But it is a thing. There is a garden style which is minimalist.
It's minimalist. It's about control. It's about form.
It's about having indoors, outdoors as well.
Sure.
And like, I also think it's about how much money you're pouring on it, because it's showing you, if you have a very maintained, manicured garden, then you are rich enough to be able to afford a gardener twice a week to be able to keep that place maintained.
Clipped and trimmed and neat and perfect.
Yes, and it's just that thing of that, you know, it gets so frustrating because the richest people of all who have the biggest swing in all of our world are going to do that and set the example, so everyone thinks, oh, I need to have that type of garden to make sure I look rich.
And meanwhile, you have cute little Argentine grass beetles living underground.
Yeah, like, why can't we have that?
or lawn grubs. I mean, nature is going to still try to occupy that niche, isn't it?
Yeah. And it will try. It will eventually.
Cockchafers and lawn grubs and things like that. I mean, it's you can't fight it.
Yeah. But like you said, that you've put so much effort and resources into keeping a green lawn through a hot, dry summer in our climate and cutting hedges. So if you've just got an area of green grass with a hedge around, like some topiary type hedges around it, and then some pot plants or whatever, you're putting, to keep them healthy, you're using more water, more resources, more of your own time, and you've still got a really bad ecosystem where, the garden you mentioned earlier that you hadn't been to for a couple of years, and you went back and you just pulled out a few plants, and that's because you created an ecology, not
it was looking after itself.
Not a
self-sustaining.
Nature abhors a vacuum.
Yeah.
And lawns are vacuums.
Yeah.
Lawns are vacuums. Hedges are vacuums. They're really useful, and I'm not saying never plant them.
No.
But it's... You don't have to have one. Like, you can have something really pretty in a small area that's not grass.
Yeah, for sure.
It's a great example of a really simplified ecosystem where when one thing goes wrong, everything, the grass just dies, right?
Yeah.
There's no robustness.
That's right.
No resilience.
When the lawn beetles... The grubs eat all the roots.
Yep. Or you get a fungal infection in your hedge and you get big brown patches through it, or the local dog keeps weighing on it or something, and then there's a big brown patch.
Yeah.
That's right.
But yeah, that you can have, even in a small area, even in a fish tank, you can have an ecology where you don't have to do that much work.
Yep.
You don't have to pick everything up or put everything in the green littered bin.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you should, if you can, don't throw anything out. If you've got organic matter, try and reuse it and put it back into the soil. That's the aim, I guess.
Yeah, for sure.
That's something to aim for.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you can still have, like, if you are a person who loves to have, you know, that bit of maintenance or control over an environment, it's like, well then, just like with all our world, try and provide like a certain percentage that you want for yourself. If there was, say, your house block is 100% in it, and your say your garden is 100%, 15% should be maybe catered around you.
Yep.
Then the rest, make sure it's a little bit more, like you still have your shrub mass, so it still looks like it's part of your garden.
Still
and
a
then,
garden.
That's right, still a garden. And then make sure at least 25 to 35% is just left alone.
Left us own devices.
And if that was the same case we did in the world, yeah. You would see better place. Mm. Like, if we just need to break the percentage rather than to all of ourselves. If we can drop this 96% of human and livestock percentage down to like what it should be, probably 30, really.
Yeah.
You would see a completely different world, you know?
Yeah.
But we're going to take over everything we do.
It is a shocking percentage that
it's terrifying.
Half the biomass of wildlife has been lost in the last 40, 50 years.
Yeah.
And if you just think of like double the amount of wildlife you see now, like,
yeah.
That would be astounding, like all over the world, especially in, you know, the rainforest. And
Yeah,
those big continuous complex systems.
Yeah, bummer. Yeah. But that's why we got to work hard and get things back and restore.
That's right.
And that's the next phase, I think.
And that's why this Gardens for Wildlife movement is actually making, it's a positive contribution that you can make as an individual.
Mm.
And as gardeners, we are in a position to actually make positive contributions to deal with some of the Earth's wicked dilemmas.
That's right.
You know, climate. Plant some trees, water some trees, cool your garden.
Yeah.
Biodiversity, plant some habitat.
Yeah. This has all happened before. Like, it's really interesting. This is going off a bit, but in the Amazons, where we think was quite an untapped, like, we think that was like an ancient forest that never had been really touched before. We know about the Incas and the Mayans and everything. But with, there's obviously a lot of deforestation happening there. But what they've been unearthing is these massive geoglyphs, like these
people
huge.
People have been there for a long, long,
long,
long time.
Long before, yeah. You know. And this is now like an absolute jungle full of life, and obviously it's happening again. But what happens is the Earth is an incredible system. It does repair itself.
And really quickly.
Really quickly. And it can be even quicker if we help it.
Yeah.
But the thing is, it will repair itself.
Yeah.
Things will change. We've already had extinctions even before we've been around.
Oh, for sure.
Some doozies.
Yeah.
Some rippers.
But
mower.
But obviously we do have the capacity as a human species to be really amazing guardians. And if we end up and still go down the path that we are, where we're not actually working with our environment, we're working against them, it's to our own demise.
Well, that's
what's going to happen.
It's actually pretty funny when people say, you know, the bees, we're losing the bees, right? I'm like, well, there are 20,000 species of bees. We will go extinct before every single one
it
of those
really will.
20,000.
And that's a weird thing, isn't it? It's because these sort of stuff's often framed as, you know, bloody greenies or something.
Oh, yeah.
And it's like, no, this is for us. Like, yeah. It's the world we live in.
Yeah.
We care. It's our home.
The world has done before and will do again, recover from huge, extinction level events.
Yeah.
And what this does is just makes it nicer for us.
Yeah.
Because we're eating our future. Like, we're literally devouring our descendants' futures.
Yeah.
That's what we're doing. And now it's getting to not just our descendants, but our kids and grandkids. Like, it's not that far, you know, it's affecting us now.
Absolutely.
We're basically the plague of locusts that they're trying to kill off.
but the recovery can be really quick, and it's often novel. You're never going to be able to replicate, you know, pure ecologically functioning systems.
No.
Like, you can't
recreate. We've changed it.
It's almost impossible. You can do it to an extent with a native grassland. You can plant a forest.
Novel ecosystems buzzwords from a couple of years ago that was really taken off.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. And an example of that's the Burrendong Botanic Garden and Arboretum that I've been involved with. Areas of that haven't been touched, like quite literally, for 15, 20 years, and it's rewilding in front of our eyes. All of the colonising plants have colonised. It's a completely, you'd call it a weedscape.
Mm. Yeah, okay. Mm.
But it's still a functioning ecology.
Weeds have a part in ecosystems as well.
Yeah. Well,
they're there for a reason.
They are there for a reason.
Yeah.
We've had Liz come through with a question for the panel. Liz is looking for recommendations for her south-facing service yard. It's wet. It's full shade in winter, and in summer it gets afternoon and morning sun. in Melbourne's west and looking for some suggestions for some garden plants. Showy lush plants are preferred. So a south-facing garden with a couple of hours sun in summer, but pretty dark in winter. So
this thing right here that I brought in is
That would be great. Let's start with that.
I brought in a plant. So a really good plant that you could plant is the Laburnia paniculata. This is a what family is it? Iridaceae?
Iridaceae.
It produces these white flowers. It's really, really good. It's found sort of northern Victoria to New South Wales and Queensland. You can mix this plant in there if you want some strappy and then some colour. Orthoxanthus multiflorus. There's fern species like Pteris tremula, which is an amazing fern species that we use a lot for... like shrubs or a bit of trees, like your Prostantheras are really, really lovely for those areas. The mint bushes. And you get, you know, that colour in late spring or even in Christmas if you get the Lazianthus, which is the Christmas mint bush. For shrub mass.
Some of the corias are pretty
good. Corias are really good.
Laurentiana and some of the forest ones.
Olearias.
Olearias, yeah, beautiful olearias, daisy bushes.
I always say olearia. So they're really good. But, I mean, back to this plant. The Laburnia, it's one that hasn't been used. Like, it's not
It's not common.
It's not common. It's a great plant. It was just... there's two species... There's nine species in Australia of... in the world of Laburnia. Two of them are here in Australia.
One in New Zealand?
There's one in New Zealand. And I think... I can't remember what that one is. Do you remember? Do you know that one?
No.
But Laburnia paniculata, and then there's Pulchella. Pachella, and that's found in the Yarra Valley and all through there. And it's a smaller species, so this one's a bit more showy.
Yeah, and it's probably a really good alternative to the Dietes, which has been planted in a lot of places.
Better. And it's a beautiful, It flower in about a month's time, usually. I'm surprised there's no stems on there, but a month or two.
Pure white flowers?
Mine are white. Yeah. They can be creamy in colour. I think there's a range between white and cream. It was named after a female botanist, actually.
Nice.
Anne Marie Libert. From Belgium.
Nice.
Yeah. And she also, she's good.
Greg, for that shady southern facing, any plants that you would think of, exotic or native?
It was western suburbs, was it?
Western suburbs, yeah. So heavy soil.
Yeah, nothing better than what we just talked about. Anyway, I don't think. There's heaps of things you could probably grow in there, like, as far as introduced stuff would be concerned. You just need understory plants, I guess, because that's basically, that's what it's, if you've got.
And ground covers.
Yeah.
Viola. Yeah, Viola heteraceae.
There'd be a lot of ground covery. If you can sort of think of woodland-type plants, they get afternoon and morning sun because the tree's growing over the top of them. They can often, especially things that grow underneath evergreens, they won't have any sun in winter at all.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's still open, so quite a few plants, especially woodland-type plants.
Yep, okay.
And then you just got to think of what sort of soil and how dry it gets in summer and how much you want to water and that sort of thing, which is why the natives are probably much more better suited for most of that things.
Thanks, mate. Lucy's asked a question about, she's got a garden in country Victoria, planted a bank. She doesn't say what species, but it's been shy to flower. Is there anything that she can do to help it flower?
No light.
Possibly a light thing?
I don't know what type it is.
No.
Yeah, I need to know the Banksias as many.
Yeah, there are many
flowers. But usually if they're not flowering, it's like a light restriction. It might be a younger plant.
Sometimes if the soil's a little bit too rich, you can just put out foliage.
Yeah.
So maybe...
Yes, that's true.
Try and step back. If you are fertilising and watering it, maybe drop that back a bit.
Yeah. Maybe getting too
stress
bushy.
Stress it into flowering.
Yeah.
That might be worth a shot. And we... have had a question come in on our email line, which is 3cr.gardening@gmail.com. And it's a question about a poor, ravaged apple tree, which is being devoured by possums. The question is, what should I do? What are some options to deal with an apple tree which is being absolutely decimated by possums?
Other than powerful owls.
Yeah. Mine's a massive tree. And
well, one of my favourite things at home now is the amount of possums my garden seems to create habitat for. My garden's just full of ringtail and brushtail possums, you know, 3.5 acres, and there's no fruit tree I can have. I'm just like, oh, it's yours, you can have it. Okay. And so the garden's for them, so I'm probably not a good person to ask about keeping them out of the trees.
Any thoughts on how to manage possums in a garden?
You know, it's hard because obviously it depends on the area that you're in. If you're just the one garden that has the apple trees, then they're going to go in and have a feed. Sometimes it's about being able to plant other species that allow it to sort of have a food source. It might be in certain areas where they're starting to get in is like maybe open it up a little bit, but then, you know, that changes the hierarchy again, but you can do that.
So possums like to move from tree to tree.
Yeah.
Yep.
So you can restrict their movement from tree to tree, that will slow them down somewhat.
Yeah.
Yep. Mm. The challenge with this one, and I would have said that canopy isolation makes sense, but it's up hard against a building. And it's an espaliered apple. Pretty tricky.
Yeah, you're really.
Do the CDs thing work?
They reflect light. There's no light at night.
Yeah. There's this spinny wheel thing that you can put on top of fences.
Right.
That Bunnings and online sells. Yeah. And what happens is when the animal goes onto the fence, it spins and it falls off. Maybe they could mount that panel above the espalier. And it'll flip them off.
Yep.
But I think they're jumping onto the plant itself. Yeah. So they're not really, unless there's like a wire or something, they're like getting
netting
there.
The whole thing.
Netting
the whole thing. Maybe make an enclosure or an exclosure.
Enclosure. And then it just like loses it. It might have to be something on top of the roof where they're jumping. You need to find where
their access point
is. What can you do there that's like not too like over the top and looks terrible, you know, and stop that access point? Mm.
I've heard someone use a motion sensor to trick an irrigation system.
Oh, yeah.
You can buy those.
Yeah, you can.
That might be worth having a look at in this because, you know, the animal comes in and it gets soaked.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, possums are quite habitual, and if that's happening every day...
Mm.
There's a possibility that they could move off.
We did that with kangaroos on a property.
Did it work?
No. They got over it. They're like, well, yeah. And then the motion sensors were just terrible and they just started going off for no reason. You're like, oh, God. At least the plants got watered.
That's sort of like a quiet gas gun, I guess, that the wineries use. It's not quite as loud. But as you say, it's startling. Like it's a sudden noise and a sudden movement and sudden things moving around, that's a startling.
Maybe explore that, a motion sensor sprinkler, which is aiming straight at the tree.
Yeah. Probably one of the best ones to do.
Yeah. I reckon that is the best. Mm. Look, we found it. There we go.
Jay, any thoughts on urban possums?
I'm just sitting here thinking of what the normal answer in New Zealand would be. It'd be very different.
Off with its head.
A very different answer,
1080. Crazier. Turn them into glass.
Audrey has put something to the text line here. It's a fantastic chat this morning. And she's calling it a painfully ordinary question. There's no such thing.
Oh, no, there's no ordinary. Such
We're
thing.
Very pleased to receive your question, which is about an aspidistra plant, so a cast iron plant that's turned pale yellow and almost white. Any idea what's happening to a green aspidistra, which has turned pale yellow?
It's cast iron plant.
Yeah, I've actually never heard of a aspidistra which is struggling.
Unless it's in like a lot of light, they don't tend to like to be in bright light.
Could be that it's just bleaching because there's too much light.
Yeah, sun.
Let's think about that one.
Yeah, so, I think most likely that.
I don't know anything about indoor plants. I'm no good.
Aspidistra, it's that cast iron. You know that.
I know the plant. Yeah. I just don't know anything about it.
I would say it's in sun. Like I've seen them go pale yellow when they've got too much light. Okay. Yeah, and it's light.
Okay.
Mm. And if you move it into a more shaded area and make sure of aspidistas, they don't want to be like fully watered all the time. Like that's why they're tough as nails. They're called cast iron plants.
Cast iron
like,
plants, yeah.
Yeah, you literally just give it a...
Throw it under the stairs for a couple of weeks.
That's right. Yeah. Throw it under the stairs, take off all the that foliage that's yucky and, you know, leave it and give it a... Yeah, I trim it right
back. Could you cut
it
right back down to the ground?
Yeah, because it has all these little shoots that come through the base and it's just, they'll be green again once it's in some shade. Yeah. It just doesn't like sun.
So it's like the maidenhair fern thing. When it looks daggy, just chop it off and let it regrow.
And it'll come back because it's indestructible.
Yeah. So, look, the suggestion, if it's in sun, move it into the shade. Yeah. If it's in the shade, maybe chop it at the base so there's no foliage left.
Yeah, and get quite it literally, start again.
And reboot it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or selectively prune them too. You don't have to cut everything if you don't have to.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. For sure. So maybe some extreme pruning, but it's an interesting one. I don't think too many of us have seen aspidistas which are failing.
Like I said, so the only time is in sun.
So yeah. Audrey, that's a particularly well played. but thanks for your comment. Mm. We've just got a couple of minutes. I'm interested in what people might do. Yeah, what's from this conversation, Jay? What's something that you would encourage people to do at home to have a more beneficial garden to invertebrate life and insects?
Yeah, well, you know, one thing we've been chatting about is like individual gardens or balcony spaces, but I think it's really important to remember your garden and is part of the broader neighborhood ecology, and if your neighbors have something. You know, positive to bring things in, that'll bring things into your garden and vice versa. And so, you know, on council, like, you know, there's only so much council can do, but what we can do as a community is work together and organize and have a lot more say and even steer the direction of what resources our council puts things into. And that includes our local neighborhoods and our nature strips, and that benefits our gardens in the end. So, you know, a pollinator corridor by the city is one thing, but our own backyards become, you know, that habitat, that wildlife.
Sure.
And that's really what I try to press upon. It's like a council can only do so much, but we can be supported. We can tell the council what to support.
Yep.
As, you know, they're representing us. And we can do that ourselves too and work with our neighbors and really organize and do that literally grassroots, you know.
Is Marybeka Gardens for Wildlife?
It is, council? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Gardens for Wildlife is an interesting one. I reckon it'd be worth people having a look at their website and some of their resources because they support that, don't they?
They do, and there's demand outstrips the ability to support it. Really,
is that right?
Maryback,
right.
Least, yeah.
Okay, so that's critical mass. Mm-hmm. We're approaching it.
Yep.
Yeah. Terrific. Em, any thoughts?
I would just say, any homeowner, I would always try, even if you have rural property or a small property, I think look into trying to. It's offset like, I don't know, 20 to 30% of your garden space towards habitat in some way.
Think about your allocation.
Yeah, and I mean, this is the same for anything like farming and everything. If you're able to just, even if it's 10 or 15%, just make sure there's a percentage that contributes to it. If we all sort of thought that way, we start to... you know, create that connective network.
Make a contribution.
Absolutely. And it is, just like what Jay said, do the contribution. Mm. Bring the network.
30 seconds, Greg.
Leave stuff on the ground.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Maybe eat a billionaire.
Yeah.
Sorry, right? It was less than 30 seconds, but I think it was pretty concise.
Maybe eat the trillionaire.
Yeah. The trillionaire.
Yeah, there's only one of them.
Well, let's make that Habitat Gardens makes you look more rich.
But leave stuff on the ground.
Yeah, indeed. It's a statement of your maturity and sophistication.
Bare ground's no good. Like, leave stuff on the ground. There shouldn't be... There's very few natural habitats where... like rock, and that's usually got lichen on it, but leave stuff on the ground. It doesn't need to be bare.
Beautiful.
Let's make knowledge expensive.
And a bit, and a bit messy.
Yeah.
Thanks, folks. You've been listening to the 3CR Garden Show. Big thank you to Emmeline, Greg, and Jay. Thanks for coming in. Thanks to Susie and Diane in the control room.
Thank you.
Tune into next week's Radiothon Extravaganza, an extended show, heaps of goodies. Being Radiothon time, I think local food connections are going to have a live show this morning. And Alternative News, I think, is going to be live from the studio. So we need to play the music, get out of here, jump into the Radiothon show next week. Thanks, folks, and catch you soon.
Thanks.
Thanks, John.
Bye.
found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.